Melania Trump, just really great people, you know, came here on H-1B visas. But in recent years, in recent decades, I'd say, fraud has become endemic in the H-1B visa, and the sheer numbers have both risen and skewed towards a very different base of countries than we were previously accustomed to seeing. And as a result, H-1Bs have become less of a tool for getting the best and brightest future taxpayers into America and more of a tool for getting cheap labor, to be as blunt as I possibly can.
Well, I'd like to kind of, you know, hear more from you, because you say kind of like the countries we're looking for or cheap labor. You know, I'm curious, you know, because there is still, you know, a requirement based on skill. You know, sure, we're not talking about our Einsteins. You kind of mentioned that there's this kind of slightly lower threshold of talent, but, you know, we're still talking about skilled labor here. I mean, you know, these are the people that, you know, come to our universities, become engineers or computer scientists, and ultimately, you know, seek in many ways to bring those talents to the American labor force and help provide the skilled labor that drives some of these industries that we're looking to excel in right now, particularly AI. And I think you see that footprint, especially here in Pittsburgh. And
this is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with a young Jewish woman from New York City who's just returned from the West Bank.
Leader Hirschman Levy, a leader with Jewish Voice for Peace, was part of a solidarity delegation to the West Bank and shares her firsthand accounts. We'll also pump the brakes and not continue further down the road to Trump autocracy.
Our guest, Norman Solomon, has just authored the free book titled The Blue Road to Trump Hell.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
Our guest today is Leader Hirschman Levy, a young Jewish New Yorker who just returned from a solidarity delegation to the Israeli militarily occupied West Bank of Palestine. Ms. Hirschman Levy is a leading activist in Jewish Voice for Peace, a writer, and an actress. Her grandparents on her mother's side were German-Jewish refugees from the Holocaust. Israel has killed at least 1,000 Palestinians in the West Bank and East Jerusalem since October 7 of 2023. The murderers are part of their project to ethnically cleanse the West Bank and East Jerusalem and make them free of Palestinians. Peace seems less and less possible. The West Bank was invaded and taken by Israel during the 1967 war, a war that was initiated by Israel against its neighbors, especially Egypt and Syria. The West Bank has been occupied by the Israeli military ever since. It is the longest occupation in history. Despite Israeli propaganda, there's no such thing as a liberal occupation. Over 700,000 Israeli settlers have since then illegally moved into the occupied territories with the intent of preventing the West Bank from being part of a future Palestinian state, a Palestinian hope which the Israelis have vowed to never allow. The territory is run on an apartheid basis, with complete segregation of Jews and Arabs, who are isolated by a 20-foot cement wall that snakes through their land. Arabs must use their own roads. They are issued distinct license plates. They suffer the indignity of military checkpoints. They go to their own schools, and they live in separate communities at the base of hills occupied by Israeli settlers. They are constantly surveilled and harassed by the military, which keeps thousands of Palestinians, including children, in prison, many tortured and detained with no charges against them. Hundreds of their homes have been destroyed, their ancient olive trees uprooted, and their water supplies stolen. It is this situation that our guest went to observe. Letha Hirschman Levy, a warm welcome to Law and Disorder Radio.
Hi, thanks so much for having me. It's an honor to be here.
Yeah, well, it's good to have you, Letha. Letha, how'd you get political?
Well, honestly, I feel like I was born into it. My parents were both active in the 60s and 70s in the civil rights movement and the women's movement. My father was a labor lawyer and did a lot of work with Center for Constitutional Rights, which I know you both know. And my mother's been an organizer her entire life. So I've been going to protests since I was in a stroller. But in terms of how I got political around the issue of Palestine, I would say it was really in college. I took an intro to Middle Eastern history class. And there was a brief section on Israel and Palestine. And it was there that I learned that Israel hasn't always existed. And having a framework in my life since I was little around civil rights and human rights and civil liberties, it felt like a really clear issue to me. And so I jumped in college with an anti-racist student group, and our first action was asking the college to divest from Israel. So that was about 20 years ago.
Well, I wonder, Lita, how specifically do you view Zionism and its relationship to anti-Semitism?
Zionism is a settler colonial project. Its goal has always been to make a Jewish majority state in a land that already has indigenous people, which are not majority Jewish. So to accomplish this, you have to displace and erase the native and then take their land. So Zionism, to me, has always been a settler colonial project, and it's a project being done under the guise of fighting anti-Semitism. It uses Judaism to justify, in my opinion, extremely violent acts. And I would say if Zionism was truly about Jewish safety, it would work towards making all countries safe spaces for Jews. It wouldn't try to round up all the Jews of the world and move them onto one land, which really makes no one safer. And I think this might be an unpopular opinion, but I also think Zionism actually creates more anti-Semitism because it equates Judaism with a system of oppression. So the more that we can separate Judaism from Zionism, really the better.
Alita, you were on a solidarity delegation that went to and just got back from the West Bank. Tell us about the delegation, please, and tell us what its purpose was.
Yeah, I was invited to join a delegation of activists traveling to the West Bank. And there were two purposes. One was to be in solidarity with Palestinian people on the ground. There is very little travel to the region right now, as you can imagine. And so we were told by Palestinian partners before going that being in physical solidarity would feel important. And, you know, they're so isolated from the world. So being there in person, one-to-one, we were told would be really impactful. And then also, as I mentioned, it was a delegation of activists. So we met with a lot of people and organizations to connect our organizing work back at home with people on the ground there and to strengthen our fight for a liberated Palestine.
And I wonder, Lita, where specifically did you go in the West Bank? And what would you say were the main lessons you learned from that experience?
So that's a really big question. The first part is easier, which is that we started in East Jerusalem, and then we traveled to Bethlehem, Hebron, Nablus, and Ramallah. And then the second part of your question feels really big in terms of what I learned. I guess my two main takeaways from my trip, while there were many, was first that the system of apartheid is actually legalized. There are so many laws in place that are only for Palestinians. And it became very clear that each law is really a trap to either kick them out of their house, off their land, put them in prison, isolate them, terrorize them. And these laws are really only for Palestinians. There are so many laws that do not exist for Israelis. So that became very clear on my trip. And then the second takeaway I would say was, you know, what I witnessed was how violently and intentionally Israel is suffocating Palestinians to make life completely impossible to live. And they're doing this, as I said, both legally and also just by practice. So I'm happy to talk about a little bit more detail about what I saw. I'll start in Jerusalem, for example, because that's where our trip started. And one thing I learned is that Palestinians who live in Jerusalem, whether they were born there, their parents born there, their grandparents born there, regardless of all of that, Palestinians who live in Jerusalem do not have Israeli citizenship, but Jews do. So what Palestinians have in Jerusalem is residency. And to maintain their residency, they have to prove that Jerusalem is, quote, their center of life every 2 years. And Israelis do not need to do this. So this is the first thing. Like, Israelis have citizenship indefinitely. Palestinians don't have citizenship, and they have to prove their residency every 2 years. And what does that look like? They have to prove that they live there, that they work there, that they go to school there in Jerusalem. How do they do this? They have to show their children's schoolwork to prove that their kids are in school there, their assignments. They have to show their paychecks, their utility bills. If they decide to go to college outside of the country or outside of Jerusalem even, they can lose their residency, which means they won't be able to return. None of this applies to Israelis. They can come and go as they please, and they remain citizens. On top of this, Israeli investigators will come into Palestinian homes to make sure that what they're claiming is their center of life is true. And the way they do this is they will look at their refrigerators and see if the amount of food looks equivalent to how many people are claiming to live there. They'll count the beds. They'll hide keys. Investigators will hide keys under the mattresses and come back 2 months later to make sure the key is still there. If it is still there, they'll claim that no one lives there because the bed hasn't been used and the keys hasn't been moved. So therefore, nobody lives there and they should lose their residency. I mean, it's like, these are the traps I'm talking about. In the last, I think, 2 years, I think it's been, 250,000 Palestinians have lost Jerusalem residency. The Palestine Authority can't issue an ID to Palestinians without Israeli approval. So, you know, this is a lot of people being affected by this, only Palestinian. Now, without residency, Palestinians can't travel. They can't pass checkpoints. They can't visit friends and family abroad. They can stay in Jerusalem, but they can't leave. And if they leave, they can't come back to Jerusalem. So we're essentially talking about Palestinians being undocumented in their own land with no freedom of movement. Another way this really affects them is that because they're not citizens of Israel, in order to travel, they need a visa to return to their own country, plus a visa to the place where they want to visit. So they need two visas when traveling. Again, none of this applies to Israelis. Another thing that becomes important in these laws around residency is that Palestinians from the West Bank, Jerusalem is technically in the West Bank, but Palestinians in the rest of the West Bank cannot enter Jerusalem. So if a Palestinian from Jerusalem marries someone from the rest of the West Bank, for example, they cannot live together because the person from the West Bank can't come to Jerusalem. And if the Jerusalemite is caught with the person from the West Bank, they can be arrested or lose their driver's license if they're driving for traveling with a, quote, unauthorized person. This is like deep ways to get people off their land and out of their homes. Another law we learned about was the absentee law. So this goes hand in hand with the residency laws, which is that if Israel determines you don't live in your home, they can claim it to be vacant and seize it and give it to Jewish settlers. So if you're arrested, for example, Israel can take your home because they claim you are, quote, absent. Or, I mean, we also heard examples of like simply leaving your house to go to work or visit a friend or, you know, go away for a weekend. This becomes dangerous if you're Palestinian, because if inspectors happen to come while you're gone, they can claim you're absent and then they can take your home. There's also laws we learned about in Jerusalem around renovating your home. Again, all these laws only for Palestinians. So Palestinians in Jerusalem cannot renovate their homes unless city officials are overseeing the construction every single day. Palestinians have to pay 900 shekels, which is more or less like $300, for the inspector each day they renovate. Israelis need no such inspector. And if during the renovation the inspectors find anything that is remotely like an archaeological artifact or ruin, the Israeli state can confiscate Palestinian homes. And this can be as small as finding an old archway. I mean, how many times do people in this country renovate their homes and, you know, they knock down a wall, find an archway? This, by Israel, can be claimed as an archaeological artifact, and they can take Palestinian homes. So these laws, they go on, and it's really so connected to land theft and getting rid of Palestinians. We visited one village called Silwan, which is in East Jerusalem. And this is another example. They're under severe settler attacks right now and land theft by the government. Israel claims that the prophet David once walked the land of Silwan, and so it's therefore, quote, Jewish territory. And I just want to say, from all the research that's been done and the excavations that have been done on this land, it all actually disproves this theory about the prophet David. But regardless, Israel claims that that's the historical thing that's happened. And so they've been demolishing Palestinian homes, and settlers have been stealing the land to create a tourist site called the City of David. So these are just like a few things that I saw specifically in Jerusalem. I mean, then we get into the whole rest of the West Bank.
Lita, Rashid Khalidi, Professor Emeritus of Middle Eastern Studies at Columbia University, writes in his book, The 100 Years War on Palestine, that it was always the intention of the Zionist movement from its beginning to overwhelm and displace native Palestinians. This has been accomplished in Gaza, pretty much. Is this being undertaken by Israel in the West Bank?
100%. 100%. As I said, every law Israel has put in place for Palestinians in the West Bank and elsewhere, all of its occupation strategies, its completely legalized system of apartheid, all are designed to make life impossible to live for Palestinians. And what I believe is hopes that they'll either leave or Israel will forcefully remove them too. Land is being taken from Palestinians all over the West Bank, and homes are being demolished every day. There are, I think, 700,000 settlers in the West Bank, and they've been given, I think in the last 2 years, 300,000 gun permits by Israel. Palestinians in the West Bank are really being terrorized. I mean, they're being imprisoned for as little as liking someone's post on Instagram, and they're being murdered. I mean, we obviously have our eyes on Gaza, but in the last 2 years, over 1,000 Palestinians in the West Bank have been killed by either Israeli security forces or settlers, and none of their murderers have been held accountable. So, yes, I absolutely agree with that statement. I can say from my experience of being in the West Bank just recently, it is really being conquered by Israel. I mean, we talk about, you know, this idea of like, let's discuss whether we should have a one-state or a two-state solution. I mean, that's a ridiculous conversation to even have, because there's so little of the West Bank left. The West Bank is divided, by the way, into three areas, Area A, B, and C, by Israel. And the PA is supposed to have control over Area A. It was clear to me in my 10 days that Israel actually controls the entire region. There is not one part of the West Bank that Israel does not control. They can raid any city, town, or village whenever they want. They regularly raid people's homes and businesses in all the areas. Ramallah, which is the third largest city in the West Bank, and it resides in Area A, had Israeli tanks roll in just last week. And the offices of UAC, which is the Union of Agricultural Work Committee, were raided. All the men in the office were arrested, and the women were sent in for questioning. This is because UAC, which is a human rights organization, and they do food sovereignty work for Palestinians, has been sanctioned by Israel as a terrorist organization. Israel has taken total control of this region. Another example of this, Nablus, which is a city in Area A as well, the IOF a few days ago went in and bombed an apartment where a Palestinian prisoner lived. They did this with complete immunity. I want to say, too, that it became clear that it's a training zone for the Israeli military. I went to a refugee camp, Aida refugee camp. It's in Bethlehem. It's 6,500 people on 0.07 square kilometers of land. So it's tiny. In 2014 to 2015, more tear gas was used in Aida refugee camp than anywhere in the world. This is a tiny piece of land, and there was more tear gas used there than anywhere in the world. Skunk water, which is now used often by the IOF against Palestinians, was first tried out in Aida refugee camp. So we're talking about a region that is really a training ground for the Israeli military. And then in terms of how, you know, Israel is really using their power to control Palestinians and then also take their land. I mean, there are tons of checkpoints throughout the West Bank, severely limiting Palestinians' right to movement. Throughout the West Bank, there are 900 gates, and they are completely controlled by Israel. So they can be closed at any time, making people's commute to school or to work impossible. And we saw them as well. When we were driving along the highway, there are red and yellow gates. Red gates are controlled by Israeli military. Yellow are controlled by Israeli military and settlers. So those two groups of people can close those gates at any time and cut off people's freedom of movement. The one thing I do really want to say, because there's so many ways in which, you know, what we're seeing in the West Bank is completely awful and horrific, but I do want to just mention that one thing that was made clear to me on my trip is that Palestinians are being terrorized, but they're not victims. And they truly are freedom fighters. And they've made it clear that their existence is resistance. And we have a lot to learn from them. So I just, as much as we, as this is horrific information, they are people that we should learn from.
Yes, indeed. Well, I wonder, Lita, too, the United States gave political, diplomatic, financial, and military support to the genocide in Gaza. What is the United States doing with respect to what's going on in the West Bank?
I mean, I think the short answer to that is that the U.S. funds Israel, and Israel controls the West Bank. So our money is supporting the occupation that Palestinians live under there. Jewish settlers are paid 3,000 shekels a month to live in East Jerusalem. Meanwhile, they can get expensive private guards anytime they want as security. And these guards are funded by U.S. groups. That's one example. The tear gas can, I saw a tear gas canister when I was in Bethlehem that said made in Pennsylvania. So our government and private U.S. groups are funneling money and arms to Israel, and it's supporting what's happening in the West Bank.
This is Attorney Michael Smith. I'm here with my former law partner and co-host, Attorney Jim Lafferty. You're listening to Law and Disorder Radio, and we're interviewing Lita Hirschman Levy, who just came back from the West Bank. Lita, when I was in Israel years ago, I met with the great Israeli human rights attorney, Felicia Langer. She tirelessly and usually futilely represented Palestinians in Israel's military courts. She said she recently toured West Germany. She was asked how Jews could do to others what was done to them. She replied that suffering is not ennobling, that a beaten child can become cruel and vicious. And then she said the Israelis have a siege psychology that is deeply implanted in them. They say we are justified in doing anything. She said the Zionist government invokes the Holocaust. She said that they've got no right to the blood of those who died as victims of fascism. Try to use these victims are themselves perpetuating fascist acts. Of these Israeli people, she said, we're not the same. They're not the same. The Israelis are not the same after 18 years of occupation. It is corrupting. If we are the chosen people, then the others are inferior. What's your response to her observations, Lita?
Yeah, I think she's absolutely right. I mean, Frantz Fanon said occupation dehumanizes the colonizer and the colonized. And that's definitely what I saw. The Israelis and settlers who are supporting an apartheid system, the occupation, the genocide, they're committing truly vile acts. And they're ones that dehumanize themselves despite their efforts to dehumanize Palestinians.
Lita, you're an activist in the New York City chapter of Jewish Voice for Peace. I wonder if you might tell us about that organization and its current efforts in this regards.
Sure. Jewish Voice for Peace is the largest progressive Jewish anti-Zionist organization in the world. So JVP organizes a grassroots multiracial, cross-class, intergenerational movement of U.S. Jews into solidarity with the Palestinian freedom struggle. And there are over 100 chapters and local formations across the country, so a lot of work is being done. I'll name some of the work, but there's obviously more. Over the past 2 years, JVP has led and participated in over 1,000 actions across the country against the genocide taking place. We're working on divesting from Israel bonds with the Break the Bonds campaign, which has actually just seen some recent divestment wins in North Carolina, Minnesota, and Michigan, which is really great. We're working on BDS efforts, and JVP Action, which is the sister organization to JVP, is doing a lot of work to transform U.S. policy by campaigning for progressive candidates that take Palestinian liberation seriously, and also working on things such as Block the Bombs. So there's a lot of work being done.
Well, Lita, there are almost 1 million Jews living right in New York City, more than any other place on earth except Israel. The older Jews in New York City tend to support Israel, while younger Jews have made quite a dramatic break with that position, haven't they? Talk to us about this.
Okay, so first I want to say that not all older Jews support Israel. And there are many wonderful Jewish elders in my life who I greatly respect and look up to, who have been fighting for a free Palestine long before this genocide started. But in terms of the younger generation, I have a few ideas. I think one is that social media is both a curse and a gift. And the way it's been a gift is that, well, this it's a very rough gift, but we're watching the genocide in Gaza live streamed, and it's horrific, but it's pulled back the blinds. And so young people who are on social media are able to see what is happening in real time without the mainstream media putting a spin on what we see to create an alternate narrative. And truthfully, when you see people in tents being burned to death, or families who are completely starved being shot at and murdered while they stand in line for food and water, or children and babies in body bags, I mean, it's a pretty clear picture of right and wrong. And I just want to say quickly that there's this rhetoric in Israel that Palestinians are using anti-Semitic curriculum in their schools, which is not only false, but Israel is in fact doing this with anti-Palestinian curriculum. But I say this because Palestinians, you know, told us we could teach our children to love Israel more than they love themselves, regardless of what we teach. When our kids step outside the door, it's Israel that teaches them the opposite by treating them like subhumans. And so I think this goes for young people across the world. Israel is showing us who they are, and we can't unsee what's been done. I think the other thing, too, in terms of young Jews and Zionism, is that I think there's more understanding around how issues are intersectional. I think there is more public discourse around the interconnectedness of struggles. For example, we can't fight ICE and police violence here in our country without recognizing the connection to Israel, which is that our officers are trained by the IOF and use the same surveillance technology and weapons. And so I think young people are recognizing more these days that all of this is connected. And lastly, I would just say that I think there's been a rejection of Zionism being the same as Judaism. And more young people are understanding that Zionism isn't the same as Judaism, and they want to reclaim their religion. That, you know, erasure of people's identities, violence, forced removal of Palestinians off their land, these are not Jewish values. And I think young people want to break from an ideology that links the two so that they can both be proud of their heritage and also have moral clarity within their religion.
Lita, unfortunately, we're running out of our allotted time. To finish up, could you please tell people how they can follow your work and that of the JVP?
Yeah, people can follow JVP by going to their website, jewishvoiceforpeace.org, and you can find your local chapter and news about what JVP is doing. And you can also follow JVP on social media, which is a great way to find out what's going on.
And how about you, Lita? Are you going to be speaking or writing about this?
Yeah, I mean, my hope is to definitely do some writing on the topic, and so hopefully it'll be out there sooner rather than later. I'm also on social media, but yes, I do hope to do some writing on this issue and get it published so that more people can know more.
Jim and I are very, very grateful for your good work, Lita. Thank you so much for being on Law & Disorder Radio.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
In 2016, a man famous for humiliating people on television with catchphrases like, "You're fired," was elected President of the United States. Many were surprised, chief among them his opponent, Hillary Clinton. But others, like our guest for this segment, saw it coming and believes that the Democratic Party could have done so much more than it did to avoid it. Today, in the midst of Trump presidency number two, the country is as polarized as ever. How did we get here? And where are we headed? Is there a way to avoid the U.S. slipping into a country where only the wealthiest enjoy power, resources, liberty, and justice? Our guest for this segment will help us think through these questions. He is Norman Solomon, author of the new book, The Blue Road to Trump Hell: How Corporate Democrats Paved the Way for Autocracy. Norman Solomon is the National Director of Roots Action and Executive Director of the Institute for Public Accuracy. He is the author of more than a dozen books, including War Made Invisible: How America Hides the Human Toll of Its Military Machine. Solomon has written about politics for many publications, including The Hill, The Nation, The Guardian, Common Dreams, and the LA Times and Salon. Well, Norman Solomon, a very warm welcome back to Law & Disorder Radio.
Hey, thanks a lot.
Listen, you've chosen a unique format for your book. The book, again, is The Blue Road to Trump Hell. Talk about the format and how it advances your overall theme and purpose.
Well, the politics of challenging corporate power should include, I think, not commercializing information and analysis as much as possible. You know, it costs to produce books and do radio stations and so forth. So inevitably, we need to ask people for money in media. But I'm very excited that here, during my 14th book, it's being published for free. And so anybody can go to blueroad.info and read The Blue Road to Trump Hell. Of course, it's available in print. But frankly, that was almost an afterthought, because I believe that there are too many friggin' paywalls in media these days, and it plays to class privilege and depriving some people of information. So long story short, it's an innovation. It's really unusual, but I'm very pleased to be part of the process.
Absolutely.
Give us again the site that they go to get the book for free.
Yes, it's blueroad.info. That's blueroad.info, and people will find the full book there. It's been published just here in December of 2025, and it's in various formats, so it doesn't require any technical knowledge. There's a PDF and there are ebooks and so forth.
Well, that's just great. Thank you, Norman. Norman, can you describe the audience that you had in mind when you were putting together your book, The Blue Road to Trump Hell?
Well, very much I wanted a broad readership, some people who have been very unhappy with the Democratic Party and wanted to find alternatives, while of course very eager to roll back the fascistic Trump regime's power, but also people who have believed that the Democratic Party lights the way to progressive change. And I think that that is a delusion. We have seen that the Democratic Party leadership, such as it is, has refused to enact basic social reforms for humanitarian change, such as Medicare for all, free public college, ending these regime change wars, stopping the military-industrial complex from determining foreign policy, and so forth. So we have had a failure on both counts of the Democratic Party leadership. They have blocked rather than advanced genuine progressive change, and they've also failed to stop this terrible right-wing juggernaut that now truly is fascistic, controlling the executive and legislative branches. And as folks at the National Lawyers Guild have been recognizing and warning us about, also the right-wing now controlling basically the judiciary, especially as you get up to the Supreme Court. So the audience is really a spectrum, as I see it, of people who are grappling with this terrible current situation that we're in, really in many ways unprecedented in our lifetimes, with the repression coming down from the federal government.
Your book begins in January of 2016, when Barack Obama was still president, but you argue that the stage was set for a Trump presidency at least a decade before that. Give us a sense of that history, a sense of what led up to that moment, if you will, when Trump was first elected.
Yeah, what led up is that when we are trying to stop bogus right-wing pseudo-populism, which is so xenophobic and racist and misogynist, it can't be done effectively in the long term in a situation of a lot of economic inequality getting worse. We can't do it with phony, pseudo-populist corporatism in the Democratic Party leadership. And so when we look at how we got here at the end of 2025 in this terrible Trump situation, I think it is important. And the book goes back to where the assumption was that the last year of the Barack Obama administration would lead into the first year of a Hillary Clinton administration. And the people running the Democratic Party, they were frankly smug. They assumed that the general population was reasonably satisfied, and they weren't, because real wages were going down, health care and education prices were going up, and so they just didn't read the national room, so to speak. And Hillary Clinton's affinity to Wall Street, getting six-figure checks for a single speech, made it really implausible for her to be successfully posing as some kind of champion of the working class. And really, I start out this book, The Blue Road to Trump Hell, by pointing out that Barack Obama came in 2009 at the time of a terrible crisis. The housing bubble had burst. There were millions of people who their life savings, basically, they had their savings in their homes, and their homes went underwater, and it was a tremendous crisis. And what Barack Obama did is he bailed out the banks, and he did not bail out the millions of people who were economically drowning. And so that was sort of a lead-in to enabling Trump to win in the first place, to pose as some kind of champion of working people.
Norman, Bernie Sanders was a candidate for president both in 2016 and in 2020. You describe how the corporate media shifted in their coverage of him as he gained in popularity. Tell us about this, please, and how it's relevant to where we are today.
Yeah, you know, when Bernie Sanders first announced for president in 2015, he was just mocked and written off by corporate media. And the line was, oh, he can't win the nomination. And then as he gathered grassroots strength, the line shifted from he can't win to, uh-oh, he could win. And this would be, we were told, a calamity. There's a classic study I cite in the book that was put forward by the Media Watch group FAIR, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. And when Bernie Sanders was at a high crest of his campaign in early 2016, the Washington Post published 16 negative articles about him in 16 hours. So when you have this big corporate outlet doing a negative article, a negative story about Bernie Sanders once an hour for 16 hours, that tells you something. They were panicked that Bernie Sanders, who's a Democratic socialist, might actually win the nomination and the presidency. And we've seen that repeated in 2020. It's part of a, what I call in the book, a repetition compulsion disorder, among those who still have a hammerlock control over the National Democratic Party, that they want to talk progressive, especially when they think it will appeal to the base at election time, but they govern very much from the corporate center. And that's involved massive militarism, nonstop wars, whether troops are on the ground or drones or missile attacks, as we're seeing now this year, as we've seen in previous years. And so it really goes to what extent we can overcome this juggernaut of the corporate media and corporate politicians and really build progressive movements from the grassroots so we can truly have Medicare for all, and we can have, as I mentioned, free public college, elder care, child care that isn't ripping people off or pushing them into poverty.
Well, Norman, your book, The Blue Road to Trump Hill, touches on some warning signs that Democratic Party leaders could have heeded, but, well, chose not to, or at least didn't. What were some of those warning signs, and what can we learn from those failures going forward?
Well, really, some of the warning signs in the last year, two that come to mind, is that after the 2022 midterm elections, Joe Biden was making clear that he was going to run for re-election as president. And that was madness. And most people in the country, according to polls, most Democrats said clearly, we don't want this guy to run for re-election. But the punditocracy and corporate media, they were pretty pleased with the guy. And they had this myth that because Biden had defeated Trump once, he would be the best person to do it again, which was nonsense because Trump had represented in 2020 an unpopular status quo. But looking ahead to 2024, when you look at the right track, wrong track polling in the country, it was very clear that the status quo was even more unpopular, and Joe Biden would represent that ongoing status quo. But that was ignored. Those were warning signs that were ignored. There were a lot of consultants who were making a lot of money, the inner circle of Joe Biden. And this is a theme of the book as well. What I call the Blue Road to Trump Hell is paved with obsequious conformity from Democrats in Congress. And so even though most Democrats in the country didn't want Biden to run again, lo and behold, it was hard to find a single Democrat in Congress to say that. So you have this gap of 60 to 70% of the Democrats in the country saying, Joe, don't run. And you had about 1% of the Democrats in Congress saying, Joe, don't run, at least saying it publicly. So that's one warning sign. The other was, when you look at the polling in 2024, throughout the year and increasingly, most Democrats, and in fact, the entire population of the U.S., wanted a cutoff of military arms aid to Israel, increasingly recognizing it for the genocide, the mass murder that it was and continues to be. And so that was a warning sign as well, because when you have most electorates saying, we don't want our tax dollars, our billions of bucks going to slaughter Palestinian civilians, you would think that a candidate who wanted to reach the Oval Office would say something along that line. Well, the opposite was the case. After Biden bowed out, Kamala Harris had the now fabled 107 days to run till the election day. And she absolutely refused to put any daylight between her and Biden in terms of continuing to arm Israel. That was a dual tragic mistake. Tragic because it continued to encourage and stoke the slaughter of Palestinian people, courtesy of U.S. taxpayers through the misnamed, the Orwellian named Israeli Defense Forces, and also was a tragedy because it helped to usher in the second presidency of Donald Trump. And the polling was clear at the time, as I cite in the book, as early as August of 2024, that if Kamala Harris had come out against continuing to arm Israel, many more people would have voted for her. But she refused to do that, and the rest is tragic history.
I totally agree with you, Norman. Why did she refuse to do it? She wouldn't even allow a Palestinian person on the stage at the Democratic National Convention. It was terrible. Let me ask you this, Norman. The last chapter of your book, The Blue Road to Trump Hell, is called All of the Future at Stake. All of the Future at Stake. In broad strokes, what's your assessment of politics in the U.S. right now?
We can't really move forward in any appreciable way without some semblance of democracy in this country. And we have seen in the last 11 months the dismantling of one democratic structure after another. And it's a prerequisite. It doesn't guarantee that we're going to have a reduction of income inequality. It certainly doesn't guarantee that we'll end having a warfare state. But it is necessary. It's necessary, albeit not sufficient. You know, we've lived through one decade after another where there were more democratic structures in place. Most of the Supreme Court, whatever the deficiencies, they weren't right-wing lunatics like six out of the nine are now. But that was necessary to have the basic elements where the gerrymandering wasn't to such an extreme level for House seats and so forth as it is now, as Texas has pointed out. So the opportunities that we have are foreclosed as long as we have these really fascistic people in control of the executive, legislative, and increasingly top of the judicial branch. And I think what is at stake is literally the future for all at many different levels. This is, as has been pointed out recently by the chair, Gray Kassar, of the Progressive Caucus in Congress, this is ethnic cleansing going on in the United States. The way in which the Trump administration has gotten the Supreme Court to agree to all these draconian repressive measures. I mean, it was unthinkable. Michael and Jim, when I look back at our lifetimes, what has been normalized is just astonishing that the Supreme Court, these flunkies for the Republican Party, have ruled this fall that it is okay to do racial targeting and that simply the language that someone speaks or the color of their skin is sufficient cause for them to be stopped on the street and questioned or pulled over. I mean, this is a repressive prerequisite for a fascistic government. And so everything is at stake, and the militarism means that literally everything is at stake. Pushing more and more closely to the precipice and over the precipice for nuclear war, that means it's all over for everybody.
I'm Jim Lafferty, along with my friend and co-host Michael Smith, and we're interviewing at the moment Norman Solomon, who is the author of the new book, The Blue Road to Trump Hell, How Corporate Democrats Paved the Way for Autocracy. Norman, one of the recurring themes in The Blue Road to Trump Hell is to not give in to autocracy, but to fight it. What should people of conscience be fighting for? What advice can you give to people who feel powerless or afraid?
It's understandable to feel powerless and afraid, but we will feel more powerless and more afraid to the extent that we become inert, to the extent that we're not able to be active. And I hear that a lot. People say, this is so discouraging. The news is so terrible. It makes me want to just turn away. But that, I believe, feels worse for people and gets worse outcomes. And so the truly enlivening possibilities are for us, not only individually, but in groups, collectively, organizing grassroots, local, regional, national, and really even international. It empowers us. It gives us the power to make the change for the better. You know, there have been terrible times before in this country, after and during World War I. Eugene Debs and others were thrown in prison for stopping or wanting to stop, trying to stop an insane war. We had during the Vietnam War tremendous repression against anti-war activists that came after the McCarthy era in the 50s. I almost said McCarthy error as well, but it was an error for this country, but it was intentional, as now the Trump administration is intentionally trying to crack down on dissent. But dissent is the lifeblood of democracy and our future. So I think often, and I put this as an epigraph in this book, The Blue Road to Trump Hell, I'm lucky enough at Roots Action to work with India Walton, who is a terrific activist. She is a Democratic socialist, was the Democratic nominee for mayor of Buffalo, New York. And I put in something that she said at a Roots Action meeting, and I jotted it down and put it in the book. She said, "The only hope is in the struggle. And when people feel hopeless, the antidote to the poison of hopelessness is to be active and work with others to make progressive change."
My own view is that people act when they feel like they can actually do something, when they have some hope. And I think the example of that is right here in New York City, where I live. I live in Brooklyn, with Zohran Mamdani. I wanted to ask you what you thought of his campaign as a Democratic socialist using the Democratic Party to get on the ballot, starting off at 1% and winning the race. How do you evaluate that victory?
Well, it goes to the point that hopelessness is a way that the system tries to crush us. And hope, not as an abstraction, but as a mobilization, is tremendously powerful. And so when we ended up with 80,000 to 100,000 volunteers, that is an example of how people can do what we are told is not possible, that they want to make change that is substantive, that can transform this country, not as individual actors or one famous leader, but understanding that this is a collective enterprise. And unlike the situation in Germany or Britain or France, we really don't live in a structure that is multi-party. I mean, I've heard really what I think are totally out of connection with reality assumptions that if we want to stop the fascistic Republican Party at a federal level, that means bypassing the Democratic Party. We may not like it. I don't like it. But I think the message is that Zohran Mamdani won because of people power. He showed that organized people can defeat organized big money. And he did it with a D after his name. And that is totally irrelevant. Doesn't matter whether it's a Democrat name after his name. What matters is that people organize and fight for power.
But the Norman, the Democratic Party is still so beholden as it is to corporate America as the Republican Party is. Has it learned that lesson that you're talking about?
Oh, I don't think at the top it's learned much lessons at all. But if you look at policy, the Democratic appointed members of the Supreme Court are different than the Republican ones. If you look at the antitrust or no antitrust at the Justice Department, tremendous difference. If you look at the crackdowns that are going on in city after city domestically, this is important. And so Ilhan Omar or Rashida Tlaib, they would not be in Congress if they weren't part of the quote-unquote Democratic Party. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez would be still a bartender. And there's nothing wrong with being a bartender. It's an honorable profession. But she's in Congress because she chose to run for the House of Representatives as a Democrat. If she hadn't chosen to do that, she would not be in the House of Representatives.
I wonder, could you tell us again, Norman, how people can get your book? Because our listeners may have missed it at the earlier part of this interview, but Blue Road to Trump Hell, How Corporate Democrats Paved the Way for Autocracy, is a book that they can get for free. Am I right?
Yeah, I'm excited about that. And I've published 14 books now with a variety of publishers, from Common Courage Press, a small one, to Dell, a very large one. And it's always an experience of we're navigating a commercial terrain called book publishing. And so it's been, necessary but frustrating to me over the last few decades to have books come out. And then people are told, well, if you want the book, you've got to pay $20, $25. So it's really exciting to me that from the outset, the book published here just in the last couple of weeks, I can say to people, yeah, if you need a print copy, you can go online and get it. But the vast majority of people who will read this book will read it for free. They'll read it as a PDF. They'll read it as an ebook. They can read it online or download it or whatever. And it's simple to do. You don't have to know anything technically. You just go to blueroad.info. That's blueroad.info. And as a result, I think it's a new way to publish books, which I think can have some real value.
Yes, absolutely. BlueRoad.info.
Yes, BlueRoad.info. That's right.
INFO. All right. Well, Norman Solomon, we thank you for making this book available for free, and we certainly thank you for joining us again here on Law and Disorder.
Well, many thanks to the whole crew of Law and Disorder, to you, Jim, and Michael, and everybody else. We need independent radio, and we need all the voices that you bring on the air.
And we certainly appreciate having yours, my friend.
Thanks so much.
And I thank our listeners for joining us here today on Law and Disorder, and I urge you all to visit our website, lawanddisorder.org, and there you'll learn ways to pledge your support for the show, and we appreciate that as well.
I wanted to die and just be
I wish I was a mole in the ground. I'd root that mountain down. And so I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Chest, the
oh, Tippy wants a $9 show. Yes, Tippy wants a $9 show. I come over the hill with a body door. Baby, when you built a wall. I've been in the band so long.
The shadows to go.
Yes, I wish I was a lizard in the screen.
It's a fun life.
If I'm a lizard in the screen, I hear my darling sing.
Cause you walk away. Really cares what I say. You turned on the light.
Can't be like your
so she
hair
put me close. Now it's that.
Can't be like your hair rolled down.
Like your hair rolled down. Like your bangs. Seems to save me now.
I wish I was a man.